To gain control over them, Beausoleil knew she needed to strike a personal alliance with key members of the Imperator's inner circle. However, the Imperator seemed to have only one confidant, and she tended to wander the Vills, like both a spy and a disciplinarian. The corridor dog-legged to the right, and she strode into a square room nearly 20 yards across. The overhead lighting was as dim as the hallway, but Baron Beausoleil's vision easily discerned the rows of little plastic boxes. They were like transparent cubes with no tops to them. She surveyed the makeshift nursery, noting with approval that the infants no longer lay listlessly on their foam pads, and only a couple were connected to IV drips. Most of the tiny children raised their huge dark eyes to her, but made no noise at all. In the recent past, the likelihood that the infants in the nursery were the last generation of hybrids was very strong. But in the intervening months, the combined resources of all the Vill's medical sections provided the Area 51 medical techs with the raw organic material to reverse their deterioration. As it was, the 15 children were the only survivors of the Archuleta Mesa catastrophe. 2,000 more had perished. But over the past few months, new cloning tanks had been installed and a blood purification system was up and running. Although the crisis to the hybrid race was not completely averted, it was no longer as acute or immediate. Leaving the nursery, the Baron strode through the narrow corridors, past a number of computer-locked doors. Because of the installation's sprawling size, Baron Beausoleil didn't even try to learn her way around, except for the way from the medical treatment section to her chambers, and even that was quite a hike, at least a mile. After what seemed like an hour, she reached her quarters. The chambers she had been given in Area 51 were Spartan compared to the opulent furnishings she enjoyed in her vill, but contained a direct vid feed to the security network and a computer terminal. The lighting was dim, but perfectly comfortable for her, whose eyes functioned best in illumination only a notch above twilight. Still, she didn't see the tall figure sitting on the bed in the corner.
"You're late, Baron. I don't like to be kept waiting."
For half a second, Baron Beausoleil stood frozen, until the voice touched chords of recognition within her mind. Then she pivoted swiftly, closing her robe at the same time and putting a welcoming smile on her face.
"I apologize, Imperial Mother. I was detained due to a report about a disturbance above."
Erica Van Sloan stood and approached her. She was nearly a full head taller than Baron Beausoleil, and equally beautiful, with a flawless complexion the hue of fine honey. Her long, straight hair, swept back from a high forehead and pronounced widow's peak, tumbled about her shoulders. Baron Beausoleil maintained the smile as she gave the woman a swift but surreptitious visual inspection. In some ways, looking at Erica Van Sloan was like looking at herself, an incarnation of pure human DNA, not leavened by Archon genetic material. She always experienced a moment of disorientation when she saw the Imperial Mother. It was difficult to reconcile the memory of the withered old hag hunched over in a wheelchair with the reality of the tall, vibrant, superbly built beauty standing before her. Like a handful of other pre-darkers, Erica Van Sloan had been revived from cryostasis when the program of unification reached a certain stage of development. She was only one of several pre-Holocaust humans, known as Freezies, who had been resurrected to serve the baronies. Beausoleil had seen Sloane a number of times over the years, particularly during baronial councils, and she had grown accustomed to seeing the craggy, seamed face, thin, straggly hair, and small and scrawny frame. Only her black eyes ever seemed to show any life. The Imperator had not only restored her youth, but he had also put life back in her legs. He also gave her purpose beyond acting as an advisor to the baronial oligarchy. Sloane dedicated her life to building a new, productive society on the framework of the Vill system. As a cyberneticist, she applied those same principles to management and organizational theory. Just as everything that occurred in the universe could be analyzed into cause and effect chains, the chains themselves could be used to build organizational models. Now, months after the overthrow of Baron Cobalt, a new model was being constructed, and Erica Van Sloan rebuilt Cobaltville so it would serve as the template for all the others. Baron Beausoleil continued to speak.
"I didn't expect you until later today. I presumed your duties in Cobaltville would detain you."
"I haven't been in Cobaltville in weeks. I've been at the Uluru installation making sure all is in readiness."
"Is the Imperator so positive that events will unfold as he has foreseen?"
It's not so much a matter of foreseeing. It's a matter of extrapolating. I don't question him any longer. I have limited time to fulfill the Imperator's wishes.
At first, the Baron wasn't sure of her meaning. Then she saw the wide strip of gray running like a bleached-out ribbon through the left side of her dark tresses. She couldn't help but notice how tense the woman seemed to be as well.
As per his wishes and conveyed through you, the pregnant female was allowed to escape the facility in order to join the exiles. She is now in place, a trump card to play whenever you or the Imperator chooses.
Erica Van Sloan seemed unmoved by her declaration.
I would prefer to see this trump card and know her name. She's too unique and valuable a resource to be referred to in that casual manner.
Of course.
She crossed the room to the computer terminal and turned it on. As the monitor screen flickered, she slid a gleaming compact disc into the port.
Her name, Imperial Mother, is Quavel.
The screen flashed, and the image of a hybrid female appeared on it. She was excessively slender and small of stature, but perfectly proportioned. White blonde hair topped her high, domed skull, brushed back from her unlined brow, and falling almost to her shoulders to curl slightly inward at the ends. The texture seemed to be a cross between feathery down and silk. Above prominent cheekbones, huge, upslanting eyes, very nearly as big in proportion to her high-planed face as those of a cat, were the clear crystal blue of mountain meltwater. They looked haunted, gleaming with a flicker of emotion that was uncharacteristic of her kind. Sloane studied her features keenly and the column of copy scrolling along the right-hand side of the screen.
So she is the one? The sole female out of dozens who actually conceived by a human male. Is there something about her that makes her special?
As you can see, she is of the Quad V genotype, first grown from existing Quadro cultures over 60 years ago. She is among the first generation.
Sloane put her hands on her hips and frowned at the image of Quavel.
Was she the only representative of that genotype who participated in the experiment?
As far as the records indicate, yes.
Where are the other Quad Vs?
We think that the female members perished in the destruction of the Archuleta Mesa installation. Quavel herself was outside the facility at the time. The other Quad Vs are male.
The Baron smiled wryly.
Hardly suitable for the purposes Baron Cobalt had in mind. As in nature, it is always the female of the species who is charged with the responsibility of saving a race.
Erica Van Sloan smiled, too, a quick twitching of the lips.
What makes the Quad V females so compatible with humans?
At this juncture, our medical techs have no true idea. They are working on finding an answer, or at least a theory. However, I submit it has less to do with the genotype than the individual, and more to do with the psychological component than a biological.
Sloan arched an eyebrow.
Explain.
The Baron reached out to the console and touched a button.
Visuals will support my hypothesis in a more satisfactory way than a dissertation.
The screen filled with a pattern of pixels, then reformed to show a high-angle view of a dimly lit room. It was little more than a cube, the only furnishings a bed and a small table holding a carafe of water and a pair of folded towels. Sloane caught her breath in surprise at the images. A tall, dark-haired man, his pale eyes glazed, his naked, muscular torso sheened with a glossy substance, stood behind Quavel. He held her nude and kneeling body up by his sinewy arms as his hips thrust rhythmically back and forth.
That is Kane. Have you ever met him face to face?
Sloane's eyes never left the screen.
Once, briefly. Months ago when my son, the Imperator, attempted to recruit him.
You are aware of the uses Baron Cobalt put him to here, are you not? His methods?
Sloane didn't reply, her attention totally fixed on the monitor. Kane's pelvis surged back and forth, the sound of wet flesh smacking wet flesh filtering through the speaker. Despite the violent way her fragile body was being jarred by the steady thrusting, Quavel's elfin face was a blank mask, her eyes closed.
Kane and a companion, a little albino creature named Domi, penetrated this facility and were captured. Kane was sentenced by Baron Cobalt to what amounted to stud service. During his 2 weeks of captivity, he was fed a steady diet of protein to speed sperm production and laced with a stimulant to provide him with hours of high energy. Since he was forced to achieve erection and ejaculation 6 times a day, every 2 days, his energy and sperm count had to be preternaturally high.
I understand that Baron Cobalt held a grudge against Cain. Was this also a form of punishment?
To a point. The Baron determined that inasmuch as Cain was responsible for the crisis, then he would contribute to its alleviation. However, the main reason he was chosen to impregnate the female hybrids was due to the fact that other human males pressed into service had performed unsatisfactorily due to their terror of our kind. At first, the females selected for the process put on wigs and wore cosmetics in order to appear more human to the sperm donors. But the men had to be strapped down, and even after the application of an aphrodisiac gel, had difficulty maintaining an erection.
She nodded to the images on the screen.
As you can see, Cain did not suffer that problem. The gel's effectiveness on him was close to 100%. He was a very adaptable man, something Baron Cobalt seemed to be aware of. Quavel also displayed exceptionally adaptive traits.
Sloane glanced at her curiously.
How so?
Watch.
On the screen, Quavel suddenly uttered a high-pitched sob and tried to suppress another one bubbling up her throat. She brought her small hands up under her and pressed their palms to the bed. With her head up and her back bowed, she pushed herself backward, meeting Cain's thrusts stroke for stroke with a growing frenzy. Her small, berry-tipped breasts trembled. She began crying out, her huge eyes wide open and aglitter with passion.
As you can see, Quavel's responses correspond with those of human females undergoing the same kind of sexual stimulation. Rather unprecedented for one of our kind, although I have heard reports that a few of our females began to enjoy such activities. Even accounting for the novelty factor, I find it puzzling.
Sloane pulled her gaze from the screen long enough to cast a challenging glance at the woman.
How so?
Baron Beausoleil shrugged.
The concept of sexual physical pleasure is not something we of the oligarchy understand as a general rule. There were rumors that the late Baron Ragnar liked to experiment in such a fashion with human women, but inasmuch as he was, as all our males are, inadequately equipped to indulge those desires, he resorted to artificial enhancements.
The Baron didn't remind Erica Van Sloan that since the male hybrids did not reproduce, their sexual organs were vestigial. Tiny reminders of the human biological material that composed perhaps a tenth of their metabolisms. She shrugged again.
Or so the rumor said. It matters not now, since he's dead.
A sharp cry from the screen commanded Erica Van Sloan's attention again. Quavel stiffened her small body, and she writhed as a torrent of little gasps spilled from her open mouth. Her gasps blurred into a broken, aspirated scream as her body locked in a spasming contraction of release.
Here, apparently, Quavel undergoes what is called an orgasm, a peaking of various and sundry stimuli.
Cain pounded harder, faster, gripping the thrashing Quavel by the waist to keep her from being driven across the bed. His hands completely spanned her lower back. Throwing his shoulders and head back, he cried out and slammed his lower belly against her upturned buttocks. His hips jerked back and forth in an explosion of orgasmic energy. Gasping, Quavel sagged beneath him, collapsing face down on the bed. Cain fell forward, supporting himself above her by quivering arms, straining briefly against her backside, as if unwilling to accept he had spent himself within her. After a few moments, he slowly withdrew from her, stumbling back half a pace.
Oh my.
Cain was still in a high state of sexual arousal, and his glistening erection looked as muscular and sinewy as the rest of his body. Quavel, her hair damp with sweat, shifted around on the bed, reaching out for him. Then the images faded from the screen.
Judging by the time Quavel exhibited the first signs of pregnancy, this was the session during which she conceived. Apparently she shifted the schedule around in order to arrange a number of trysts with Cain.
Erica frowned toward her, but the Baron noticed the faint dew of perspiration at her temples, and the peaks of her breasts straining at the satiny fabric of her tunic.
Why did you show me this?
It's a historic record in a way. The first new human impregnated by an old human. A hybrid of a hybrid.
Sloane nodded, veiling her eyes with half-lowered lashes.
Don't you know hybrids take on all the positive attributes of their parents, becoming the most exceptional specimens?
Baron Beausoleil assumed the question was rhetorical, more in the way of a quote, so she said nothing. Sloane gazed at her steadily, a sour smile tugging at the corners of her mouth.
Historical record? In my day, we would have called it pornography or voyeurism.
The Baron regarded her with wide, innocent eyes.
Indeed. If the images disturbed the Imperial Mother, I apologize.
Erica Van Sloane gestured impatiently.
I don't find them disturbing. It's just that I don't have your level of detachment while watching... Never mind.
I admit I found them interesting, particularly the revelation that Quad Vs, or one of them, possessed such a reservoir of passion. Nor can I deny that the images awakened a faint spark of sexual energy in me as well.
Sloane's eyebrows knitted at the bridge of her nose.
For Cain?
That hunching, slouchy brute? No, I am intrigued by Quavel's responses, and the fact that at her first opportunity she fled from here to be with him, just as you predicted. She is the mystery, not Cain.
Sloane favored her with a quizzical stare. Her smile became one of pity.
You really don't know, do you?
I confess I do not know the touch of a man, nor do I ever care to be victimized by the kind of ministrations performed by Cain.
With a calculated boldness, Baron Beausoleil flicked her eyes up and down the taller woman's lissome figure.
But the beauty of womankind is always arousing.
Erica Van Sloane's eyes widened in surprise, and a pulse suddenly beat in her throat.
What do you mean?
The Baron sidled up close to her, just as she had done to Maddock only minutes before.
I mean, we can be a great deal of help to each other, Imperial Mother. We are engaged in a mutually beneficial plan. You need me to fulfill the Imperator's wishes in the matter he pursues. As his intermediary, you need one of the oligarchy whom you can trust implicitly.
And you are that one?
Who else? We are women of status in a male-dominated society. We should have no secrets from each other. We are an empire unto ourselves, far from the petty ambitions of my brother barons.
As she spoke, Baron Beausoleil, with slow, sinuous movements, undid the sash of her robe and let it slide from her body.
I bear myself before you.
Sloane only stared at her. The Baron caught her gaze and held it unblinkingly, violet eye to violet eye.
You and I are alike, utterly beyond the laws and protocols of this society. For us to make love would be like making love to ourselves. That prospect fills me with desire.
This isn't proper.
Baron Beausoleil pressed herself against the taller woman's body, rising up on the balls of her feet in order to push her nipples against Sloane's.
We make the rules. We decide what is proper.
The Baron cupped Sloane's face between her hands.
And we decide the fate of our females and their issue.
Moaning softly, Erica Van Sloane closed her eyes, lowered her head, and kissed Baron Beausoleil's upturned mouth. The corners were curved in a faint, triumphant smile. The late afternoon sun flooded the broad plateau with a golden radiance, striking highlights from the scraps of the chain link enclosing the perimeter. The breeze smelled fresh, rich with the hint of spring growth wafting up from the foothills far below. As he stepped through the open sector, Filboid inhaled gratefully, deeply.
Not a trace of fluorocarbons. I guess there's an upside to everything, even a nuclear war.
Brigid Baptiste couldn't help but laugh.
Was the atmosphere so saturated with pollutants before the nuke you could smell them even at this altitude?
To be honest, I wouldn't know. I wasn't much into mountain climbing.
He gave her a slightly abashed smile.
I was just trying to make conversation.
Filboid was a tall man, a little over 6 feet, long-limbed and lanky. He wore a white zippered coverall, the unofficial duty uniform of Cerberus personnel. Blonde-white hair was swept back from a receding hairline. He wore black-rimmed eyeglasses, and his cheeks appeared to be pitted with the sort of scars associated with chronic teenage acne. The red wheal of a healing gash showed starkly against the pale flesh of his forehead. Brigid nodded in understanding.
Well, the air is pure enough up here, unless we get a chem storm, which isn't very likely at this time of the year.
The breeze ruffled Brigid's red-gold mane of thick, wavy hair, arranging it artlessly over her shoulders and upper back. Her fair complexion was lightly dusted with freckles across her nose and cheeks. Her big, feline-slanted eyes, beneath the rectangular lenses of her wire-framed spectacles, weren't just green. They were a deep, clear emerald. She wore a white bodysuit identical to Philboyd's, which showed off her willowy figure to full advantage. It was slender, but rounded and taut, long in the leg, her arms rippling with hard, toned muscle.
Chem storms? Huh. It's been a long time since I saw any kind of storm.
You were lucky to have missed out on those.
Brigid felt a little strange to be discussing the weather with the man, but then weather was still something of a novelty for him. Philboyd nodded in comprehension.
I read a little about the nuclear winter in the database here. You call it Skydark, right?
Right. Ratio-wise, it killed more people than the actual nuke.
2 centuries before, the hundreds of very nearly simultaneous nuclear explosions had propelled massive quantities of pulverized rubble into the atmosphere, clogging the sky and blanketing the planet in a thick cloud of dust, debris, smoke, and fallout. For nearly 20 years, it was as if the very elements were trying to purge Earth of the few survivors of the atomic megacull. The exchange of nuclear missiles did more than slaughter most of Earth's inhabitants. It distorted the ecosystems that weren't completely obliterated. The entire atmosphere of the planet had been hideously polluted by the nuke cost, producing all manners of deadly side effects in the ecosphere. After 8 generations, the lingering effects of the nuke cost and the Skydark were more subtle, an underlying texture to a world struggling to heal itself. But the consequences of the war still let themselves be known from time to time, like a grim reminder to humanity to never take the permanence of the species for granted again. One of the worst and most frequent side effects were the chem storms, showers of acid-tainted rain that could scorch the flesh off any mammal caught in the open. They were lingering examples of the freakish weather effects common after the Holocaust and the nuclear winter. Chem storms were dangerous partly because of their intensity, but mainly because of the acids, heavy metals, and other chemical compounds that fell with the rain. In the immediate aftermath of the nuke cost, chem storms could strip flesh from bone in less than a minute. As the environment recovered, the passage of time diluted their potency, but the lethal acid rain could still melt flesh from the bones during long exposure. Fortunately, chem storms were no longer as frequent as they had been even a century before, but the peculiar geothermals of hell zones seemed to attract them. Although fewer hell zones existed now, there were still a number of places where the geological or meteorological effects of the nuke cost prevented a full recovery. The passage of time could not completely cleanse the zones of hideous, invisible plagues. The west coast of the United States was one such zone, where most of California was underwater. The best-known zone was the miles-long D.C., New Jersey, New York corridor, a vast stretch of abandoned factory complexes, warehouses, and overgrown ruins. D.C., otherwise known as Washington Hole, was still the most active hotspot in the country. Brigid still retained vivid and unpleasant memories of her one visit to the hole. Only a vast sea of fused black glass occupied the tract of land that once held the seat of American government. Seen from a distance, the crater lent the region the name by which it had been known for nearly 2 centuries. Washington Hole was the hell zone of hell zones, a great wilderness of radioactive dirt and debris where no life remained. Even so, Philboyd had expressed an interest in seeing the place for himself. Brigid guessed that since he had spent most of his adult life cloistered in an artificial environment, breathing recycled air, the past month he had spent at the Cerberus Redoubt was almost as disorienting as visiting an alien planet. He had spent the past 200-plus years on the moon, so Earth did indeed seem alien to him, as did the installation built deep inside a Montana mountain peak. Constructed in the mid-1990s, no expense had been spared to make the redoubt, the seat of Project Cerberus, a masterpiece of concealment and impenetrability. The redoubt had housed the Cerberus process, a subdivision of Over Project Whisper, which in turn had been a primary component of the totality concept. The researches to which Project Cerberus and its personnel had been devoted were locating and traveling hyperdimensional pathways through the quantum stream. Once that had been accomplished, the redoubt became, from the end of one millennium to the beginning of another, a manufacturing facility. The quantum interface Mattrans inducers, known colloquially as gateways, were built in modular form and shipped to other redoubts. The 30-acre, three-level installation had come through the nuke cost with its operating systems and radiation shielding in good condition. When Mohandas Lakesh Singh had reactivated the installation some 30 years earlier, the repairs he made had been primarily cosmetic in nature. Over a period of time, he had added an elaborate system of heat-sensing warning devices, night vision vid cameras, and motion trigger alarms to the surrounding plateau. He had been forced to work in secret and completely alone, so the upgrades had taken several years to complete. However, the location of the redoubt in Montana's Bitterroot Range had kept his work from being discovered. In the generations since the nuke cost, a sinister mythology had been ascribed to the mountains, with their mysteriously shadowed forests and hell-deep, dangerous ravines. The wilderness area was virtually unpopulated. The nearest settlement was nearly 100 miles away in the flatlands, and it consisted of a small band of Indians, Sioux and Cheyenne. Planted within rocky clefts of the mountain peak and concealed by camouflage netting were the uplinks with the orbiting Vela-class reconnaissance satellite and a commsat. It could be safely assumed that no one or nothing could approach Cerberus undetected by land or by air, not that anyone was expected to make the attempt, particularly overland. However, there had been a recent exception. The road leading down from Cerberus to the foothills was little more than a cracked and twisted asphalt ribbon, skirting yawning chasms and cliffs. Acres of the mountainsides had collapsed during the nuke-triggered earthquakes nearly 2 centuries ago. It was almost impossible for anyone to reach the plateau by foot or by vehicle, and Lakesh had seen to it that the facility was listed as irretrievably unsalvageable on all Vill records. Phil Boyd and Bridget walked across the broad, tarmac-topped plateau to where Kane's Manta ship rested on its landing gear. He was busy inspecting the battle damage inflicted on it, and so affected not to notice the approach of the two people. Bridget knew his apparent preoccupation was a pose. Kane's senses were so finely honed that not even a sparrow flitting overhead could have escaped his notice. He had arrived back at Cerberus less than 10 minutes before, transcoming to the redoubt a very brief overview of the events at Dreamland and Grant's decision to take a lengthy detour. When Phil Boyd saw the depressions and dents scarring the Manta's hull, he whistled in surprised consternation.
Holy shit, Kane. You didn't tell me you took this much fire.
Kane straightened from beneath the Tav's tail assembly and regarded him darkly.
You didn't ask, Phil Boyd.
The man walked around the craft, shaking his head in disbelief.
Do you know how old these crates are?
No, and neither do you.
Bridget repressed a smile.
The metallurgical analysis Bry performed on the hulls suggested they were a minimum of 10,000 years old.
Being stored on the moon for all those millennia kept them in perfect working order.
Phil Boyd nodded.
Too bad the same couldn't be said for me.
Phil Boyd, like the Tavs, had been on Earth a little less than a month. Without the intervention of Bridget, Kane, and Grant, both he and the Mantas would have remained on the moon for eternity, forgotten relics of two past ages. A mission a few months before had brought Grant, Bridget, and Kane to a totality concept installation on an isle in the Pacific Ocean, situated on one of the Santa Barbara Islands. Within the facility, they had discovered a special encoded program called Parallax Points. Bridget and Lakesh made several visits to the facility, salvaging what they could. Most of the machinery was damaged beyond any reasonable expectation of repair, but the data pertaining to parallax points was retrieved and put to use, including the black protective garments Kane had named shadow suits. After weeks of study, they learned that the parallax points program was actually a map, a geodetic index of all the naturally occurring vortex points on the planet. That discovery spurred Lakesh to build the second version of a device he referred to as an interphaser, or to be technically precise, a quantum interphase matter transmission inducer. The interphaser had evolved from the totality concept's Project Cerberus. Before the nuke cost, the objective of Project Cerberus was essentially devoted to converting matter to energy and transmitting the energy to a receiving unit and converting it back again to matter. Although a working teleportation device had been more or less perfected in the latter years of the 20th century with the development of the Mattrans gateway units, Lakesh had gone even beyond that accomplishment. 2 years before, he had constructed a small device on the same scientific principle as the Mettrans inducers, an interphaser designed to interact with naturally occurring quantum vortices. Theoretically, the interphaser opened dimensional rifts, much like the gateways, but instead of the rifts being pathways through linear space, Lakesh had envisioned them as a method to travel through the gaps in normal space-time. However, the interphaser was more than a miniaturized version of a gateway unit, even though it employed much of the same hardware and operating principles. The Mettrans gateways functioned by tapping into the quantum stream, the invisible pathways that crisscrossed outside of perceived physical space and terminated in wormholes. The interphaser interacted with the energy within a naturally occurring vortex and caused a temporary overlapping of two dimensions. The vortex then became an intersection point, a discontinuous quantum jump beyond relativistic space-time. According to Lakesh, evidence indicated there were many vortex nodes, centers of intense energy, located in the same proximity on each of the planets of the solar system, and those points correlated to vortex centers on Earth. The power points of the planet were places that naturally generated specific types of energy, possessing both positive and projective frequencies, and others that were negative and receptive. He referred to the positive energy as prana, which was an old Sanskrit term meaning the world soul. Lakesh was sure some ancient peoples were aware of these symmetrical geo-energies and constructed monuments over the vortex points in order to manipulate them. He suspected the knowledge was suppressed over the centuries. Apparently, the Parallax Points program was a rediscovery of those ancient principles. Decrypting the program was laborious and time-consuming, and each newly discovered set of coordinates was fed into the interphaser's targeting computer. But for the first time in 200 years, the Cerberus Redoubt reverted to its original purpose, not a sanctuary for exiles or the headquarters of a resistance against the tyranny of the barons, but a facility dedicated to unraveling the eternal mysteries of space and time. Cain, Grant, and Bridget had endured weeks of hard training in the use of the interphaser on short hops, selecting vortex points near the redoubt. Or at least near in the sense that if they couldn't make the return trip through a quantum channel, they could conceivably walk back to the installation. Only recently had they begun making jumps farther and farther afield from Cerberus. So far, the interphaser hadn't materialized them either in a lake or an ocean or underground, a possibility that Cain privately feared. He knew an analog computer was built into the interphaser to automatically select a vortex point on solid ground. However, everyone was nonplussed when one set of parallax point coordinates led to a location not just on solid ground, but off the planet itself, on the moon. All of them knew the stories about pre-dark space settlements, even of secret bases on the moon, one of the largest built in the Menetius crater region. That particular site was chosen because of its proximity to artifacts that some scientists speculated were the shattered remains of an incredibly ancient city, once protected by massive geodesic domes. A remote probe had been dispatched first, and it returned not just with evidence the Menetius moon colony was still inhabited, but populated by a disaffected group of scientists, marauding packs of Carnobots, and both a flesh-and-blood devil and a machine known by the acronym Devil. Phil Boyd was one of the scientists, as were several others who had recently arrived in the Cerberus Redoubt via the more conventional gateway units rather than the interphaser.
You mind if I check her over? I might find some damage you missed.
Cain waved grandly toward the Manta.
Be my guest.
As Phil Boyd strolled around the Tav to look at the rudder assembly, Bridget spoke quietly to Cain.
Lakesh is waiting for your full report.
Cain shrugged.
Let him wait. I gave him all the high points over the comm.
Bridget sighed and adjusted her glasses to examine bullet pocks on the Manta's hull. More than 6 months before, she had suffered a head injury serious enough to open her scalp to the bone and put her in a coma for several days. The only sign of it now was a faintly red horizontal line on her right temple that disappeared into the roots of her hair. Although her recovery time had been little short of phenomenal, Cain noticed how she needed her glasses more and more over the past half year. Bridget spoke softly without looking at Cain.
Quavel's not going away, Cain. It's been almost a month. You're going to have to accustom yourself to her presence here sooner or later.
He stopped short of glaring at her.
I will when you will.
Bridget looked at him, irritation glittering in her jade eyes.
I've come to terms with how she came to be here and the circumstances surrounding her condition. I already told you, I don't blame you.
He nodded, his lips stretched in a tight, grim line.
But that's about all you've said about it.
She combed nervous fingers through her mane of hair.
You were the one who didn't want to talk about it for the past 6 months. I respected your privacy. Besides, I remember what you told me when I first asked you about what happened to you in Dreamland. Baptiste, if I told you about it, you'd be very sorry that I did.
As the possessor of an eidetic memory, she couldn't claim to have forgotten what Kane told her all those months ago on Nuedo. Brigid Baptiste remembered everything she read, heard, or saw, and that was how and why she ended up as an exile, like Kane and Grant.
You gave me fair warning, and I accepted that.
So I did. But what you don't say is if you've accepted the reason she gave for being here.
She feared for the safety of her child. Your child.
Kane grimaced.
You don't know that. I don't know that. She's never made that claim either.
Brigid smiled, but it had little humor or warmth in it.
Only because you've refused to undergo genetic testing.
Kane didn't respond to her rejoinder.
She's a hybrid, and her being here is some kind of baronial ruse or a trap concocted by the Imperator.
Although he hadn't told either Grant or Brigid about his experiences in Dreamland, he hadn't known why he wanted to keep it a secret. He hadn't volunteered for stud service, after all. And it wasn't shame that kept him mute on the topic. At least, it hadn't been.
Her being here has more to do with you or Domi. You claim you don't recall telling Quivel about the redoubt, but you were drugged much of the time.
So was Domi.
So she might have been the one who spilled the beans on our location. But Quivel has been watched constantly since she arrived, and she's shown no indication of trying to get a message out.
Kane made a dismissive gesture.
That doesn't prove a goddamn thing, Baptiste. Do you really buy her story that Maddock helped her escape?
Why not? Domi buys it, since he helped the two of you escape. And if he seemed to be in love with Quivel, like you said, then it stands to reason he would do what he could to smuggle her out of Dreamland, even if it meant sending her to you.
Kane refused to be swayed by her reasonable tone.
You know how cunning the Barons, all the hybrids, are. She could be a component in a long-range plan hatched by the Barons. For example, why would she fear for the safety of her baby, since it was by Baron Cobalt's edict that she even conceived?
That was Cobalt's plan only, and it was apparently not condoned by the entire oligarchy. But the answer is obvious. If female hybrids can conceive offspring by human males, then a continued division between the so-called old and new human is pretty much without merit. And without a division, then the Barons can no longer rule. To them, Quivel's child represents a future wherein they are no longer unique or superior.
Her lips quirked in a wry smile.
The other possibility is one you've refused to consider since the day we came back from the moon and found her here. That she simply wants to be with the father of her child when her time comes to give birth.
Kane jerked slightly in reaction to her words. His mouth twisted as if he tasted something exceptionally sour.
Quivel has barely spoken 20 words to me since I came back.
No, you've barely spoken 20 words to her. You've found some excuse or another to keep as far away from her as you can. It used to be called avoidance behavior, but now it's getting a little ridiculous, particularly since she's going to require more pre- and postnatal medical aid than our infirmary can provide.
She broke off when she saw Kane stiffen, his eyes narrowing as he looked past her.
Oh, shit.
Brigid turned to see Domi strolling across the plateau from the direction of the sector. She was a small, curvaceous white wraith, barely a shade over 5 feet tall. Her flesh was the color of a beautiful pearl, and her ragged mop of hair the hue of bone. Though petite to the point of being childlike, she was exquisitely formed. Eyes like drops of freshly spilled blood gleamed on either side of her thin-bridged nose. She wore a black t-shirt and a pair of red, high-cut shorts that showed off her pale, gammon-slim legs. She was barefoot, as usual.
Am I interrupting something?
Brigid shook her head ruefully.
Not really. It's just the same topic of conversation Kane and I have beaten to death for the past few weeks. Quivel's reasons for being here.
Domi acknowledged the comment with a playful smile directed at Kane.
Nothing to be suspicious about. From what I heard, you got a 30-30 between your legs and she's only a 22 cal.
Kane winced at the vulgar comparison, but decided to let the observation pass without comment. Due to her upbringing in the Outlands, Domi was always forthright and freewheeling in her manner. Months ago, he had sworn her to secrecy about the details of his captivity, and the albino girl had kept her word, in spite of being confused by his reluctance to tell anyone about it. To his surprise, Bridget Baptiste didn't seem to be discomfited by her crude remark.
I seriously doubt sexual attraction is a motivating factor among the hybrids. They're intellectuals, first and foremost. The most mentally inferior of them probably have quadruple-digit IQs.
Kane didn't respond to her opinion. He glared at Domi.
Is there a reason you came out here other than to harass me?
Domi's playful smile widened into a grin.
The topic of your conversation wants to see you, both of you. I volunteered to fetch you, since her condition keeps her from getting around too much.
Kane scowled down at her.
You're really enjoying this, aren't you?
The grin fled from Domi's face, and she regarded him gravely for a silent moment. Then the grin returned.
Yes. Yes, I am.
The Cerberus Redoubt was built inside the mountain peak. The multi-ton sector opened like an accordion, folding to one side, operated by a punched-in code on a keypad and a lever control. Nothing short of an anti-tank shell could even dent it. A large illustration of a three-headed, froth-mouthed black hound was rendered in garish pigment on the wall near the control lever. Underneath the image, in an ornately overdone Gothic script, was written the single word, Cerberus. The main corridor, 20 feet wide, was made of softly gleaming vanadium alloy and shaped like a square with an arch on top. Great curving ribs of metal and massive girders supported the high rock roof. From the main corridor, side passages and elevators led to a well-equipped armory, bunk rooms, a cafeteria, a decontamination center, an infirmary, a gymnasium with a pool, and even a detention area. The redoubt had been constructed to provide a comfortable home for well over 100 people. Although there were far fewer than that now, there were still more than there had been in the past two centuries. Just as Kane wasn't used to Quavell's presence in the Cerberus Redoubt, he also had yet to grow accustomed to seeing more than one or two people in the corridors. When he, Grant, Domi, and Bridget had arrived at the installation 2 years before, there were only a dozen permanent residents. They were all exiles from the Vills, although they had been brought there by Lakesh because of their training and abilities. For a long time, the Cerberus personnel were outnumbered by shadowed corridors, empty rooms, and sepulchral silences. Over the past 3.5 weeks, the corridors had bustled with life, the empty rooms filled, and the silences replaced by conversation and laughter. The immigrants from the Menetius base had been arriving on a fairly regular basis ever since the destination lock code to the Luna Gateway unit had been discovered. Kane had stopped counting the new arrivals when he reached a dozen. Whether they intended to remain in the installation or try to make separate lives for themselves in the Outlands was still an open question. As Kane and Bridget strode along the passageway, he noticed heads of men and women turning toward him, and he heard his name whispered. Glamour, that's what I've got, he reflected sourly. Kane couldn't really blame the people for staring, not just at him, but at Bridget too. If Grant had been present, they would have gaped at him as well. The actions performed by the three of them had freed the Menetius base inhabitants from lives of unending terror and offered them an alternative to dying unknown and unmourned on the moon. But Kane's status among the Menetius emigres sprang more from the fact that he had faced the fearsome Tuahadidanan McCann and imprisoned him in a stasis chamber than from freeing them from a lunar tomb. Kane recalled what Bridget had said to him after Tibetan bandits had bestowed upon him the title of Tsayanus Kanpo, the King of Fear. She had wryly commented that he was earning quite the reputation in the far corners of the world. Less than a month afterward, when Sky Dog's warriors had bestowed upon him the name of Unktomi Shunkaha, or Trickster Wolf, he had realized that he was crossing over the road from flesh-and-blood man into the realm of legend. He wasn't pleased by the prospect. Kane, Domi, and Bridget entered the Central Operations Complex, the brain of the installation. A long room with high, vaulted ceilings, It was lined by consoles of dials and switches, divided by an aisle of computer stations. A huge Mercator relief map of the world spanned one wall. Pinpoints of light shone steadily in almost every country, connected by a thin pattern of glowing lines. They represented the Cerberus network, the locations of all indexed functioning gateway units across the planet. On the far side of the center was an anteroom, and on the far side of that stood a MAT-TRANS unit. The jump chamber itself, elevated on a circular metal platform, was enclosed on all sides by 8-foot-high slabs of translucent brown-tinted armaglass. Bry sat at the Biolink telemetric monitor, and he nodded his copper-curled head in a greeting as Kane and Bridget entered. A round-shouldered man of small stature, his white bodysuit bagged on him, he served as something of Lakesh's apprentice. Quavel sat at the Master Ops console. Reba DeFore and Lakesh stood on either side of her, gazing at the images flashing across the big VGA monitor screen. The hybrid female was small, smaller even than Domi. Her huge, upslanting eyes of a clear crystal blue gave Kane a silent appraisal. White blonde hair, the texture of silk threads, fell from her domed skull and curled inward at her slender shoulders. Her tiny form was encased in a silver-gray, skin-tight bodysuit. It only accentuated the distended condition of her belly and the slenderness of her limbs. Lakesh turned toward them when they approached, fixing his intense blue gaze on Kane. His eyes glinted with an angry impatience.
"I cannot comprehend how Grant could be so irresponsible as to fly one of the craft we have on loan from our Menetius friends to New Edo without asking permission."
Kane stared challengingly into Lakesh's bright blue gaze, but the man never flinched. Kane still hadn't grown accustomed to dealing with a robust, relatively speaking, Lakesh, whose eyes weren't covered by thick lenses, whose voice no longer sounded like a reedy rasp, and who didn't look like a hunched-over, spindly old man who appeared to be fighting the grave for every hour he remained on the planet. The Lakesh he had first met was a wizened apparition of a man who looked exceptionally old, but nowhere near his true chronological age of 250 years. He had spent a century and a half of those years in cryogenic stasis, and after his resurrection 50 years ago, he had undergone several operations to further prolong his life. He had been given healthy replacements for his own bad heart, lungs, and eyes. Calcified, arthritic joints in his shoulders and legs were replaced with new ones made of polyethylene. None of the surgeries or enhancements had been performed out of Samaritan impulses. His life and health had been prolonged so he could serve the program of unification and the baronies. When he finally understood the full magnitude of the horrors the unification program had wrought on humanity, he was determined to fight the Baron secretly from his position as chief archivist in the Cobaltville Historical Division. Now, Lakesh was a well-built man of medium height, with thick, glossy black hair, an unlined, dark olive complexion, and a toothy grin. He looked no older than 45, despite a few strands of gray streaking through his temples. Kane recognized only the blue eyes and the long aquiline nose as belonging to the Lakesh he had known these past 2 years. Lakesh attributed his restored vitality to Sam, the Imperator, who claimed he had increased Lakesh's production of catalase and superoxide dismutase and boosted up his alkyglycerol level to the point where the aging process was for all intents and purposes reversed. Kane recalled that for the first few weeks following Sam's treatment, Lakesh's hair had continued to darken, and more of his wrinkles disappeared. But then the entire process reached a certain point and came to a halt. He didn't try to convince himself that his condition was permanent. He had no idea how long his vitality would last, whether it would vanish overnight and leave him a doddering old scarecrow again, or whether he would simply begin to age normally from that point onward. He couldn't be certain. Kane suspected that Lakesh was taking full advantage of his restored middle age. The glances he caught Domi and Lakesh exchanging from time to time told him that. He was also increasingly assertive and challenging, confrontational behavior that Kane attributed to his restored youth. Still, Kane was no more inclined to tolerate high-handedness from a middle-aged Lakesh than an elderly one, so he responded to this accusatory statement with a taunting smile.
"Yes, it was irresponsible, wasn't it? I mean, He acted like a man who essentially saved the solar system a few weeks back and who makes his own decisions without calling home to ask if it's all right if he misses dinner.
He shook his head in mock disbelief.
Shocking.
Lakesh was not in the least mollified by Kane's sarcasm.
Worse, he acted like you.
Kane glared at him. He fought down the anger rising in him. At the moment, with Quivel within arm's length, he didn't feel like continuing the feud that had begun on the very first day he and Lakesh exchanged words. Over a year before, Kane, Bridget, and Grant had staged a mini-coup. Lakesh hadn't been completely unseated from his position of authority, but he was now answerable to a more democratic process. At first, he bitterly resented what he construed as the usurping of his power by ingrates, but over a period of time, he accepted sharing his command with the other Cerberus exiles. It was the only fair tactic to take, since the majority of them were exiles due to his covert actions. Almost every person in the redoubt had arrived as a convicted criminal, after Lakesh had set them up, framing them for crimes against their respective vils. He admitted it was a cruel, heartless plan with a barely acceptable risk factor, but it was the only way to spirit them out of their vils, turn them against the barons, and make them feel indebted to him. This bit of explosive and potentially fatal knowledge hadn't been shared with the other exiles. Only Kane, Grant, and Bridget were aware of it. Lakesh's displacement from a position of total authority hadn't improved his relationship with Kane.
Give it a rest, Lakesh.
Kane gestured to the biolink monitor that displayed icons representing heart rate and blood pressure.
Grant is fine. You can see that. He'll be back here before you know it.
Lakesh glowered at him.
It is not his health I'm concerned about.
Then what has you so wired up?
Quivel spoke calmly in her musical yet childlike voice.
I am the cause.
He repressed the urge to say, why am I not surprised? Kane turned to face her. To his relief, she wasn't looking at him, but at the images on the monitor screen.
And why is that?
Her big eyes shifted toward him, and not for the first time, Kane felt a strange sensation, almost physical, like a warm hand stroking the base of his spine. During the first few months following his captivity, Kane had successfully managed to keep from dwelling on memories of his forced fornications. But even when he gained a certain degree of emotional distance from those experiences, he found himself thinking of Quivel. When he first saw her in Area 51, he recognized her immediately. During his escape from ruins of the Archuleta Mesa, he had kept Domi from killing Quivel. He had never let on he knew her, and she behaved like the encounter never happened. He knew, however, that hybrids forgot nothing, no matter how trivial. Images of Quivel seemed to insinuate themselves into his mind during the hazy period between wakefulness and sleep. When he drowsed, he fancied he could feel her silky blonde hair between his fingers, or he saw eyes of a clear crystal blue gleaming with emotions that were uncharacteristic of her kind. Kane easily recalled other ways in which Quivel was different from the other females he had serviced. Almost all of them mounted him and rode him mechanically, not even looking at him. It was obvious they would have never engaged in intercourse with any human male but for Baron Cobalt's orders. Although his memories were fragmented due to the aphrodisiac gel that induced a blind rutting fever, he retained a hazy recollection of her crying out in wild abandon during their last coupling. Her image would waver in his mind, then it would change, and he would see her with a belly grown large with child, her long fingers clasped protectively over it, her delicate face displaying her determination to keep safe the life growing in her womb. Kane would jerk back awake at this point in the imagery, consumed by a bewildering blizzard of unfamiliar and disturbing emotions. He was never sure if the mental pictures were examples of free association or if Quivel was telepathically transmitting a message when he was the most susceptible. Or, he reflected again, everything he had gone through could have been part of a complicated ruse. It certainly wouldn't have been the first time the hybrids tricked and lied to their human allies, or pawns. He also remembered how Quivel had reacted when he questioned her in Dreamland if it were truly possible for humans and hybrids to procreate. Although she claimed they were chromosomally compatible, she had admitted the procedure was still experimental. Then Quivel had smiled at him in a way he could only interpret as coquettish. One of her long fingers traced the faint scar on his left cheek.
But some of us here, me at least, find the process of trial and error very enjoyable.
The most recent memory of Quavell was not hazy in the least, though he wished it were. He still recalled with shocking clarity his first sight of her sitting in Lakish's office when he entered to brief him about the events that had occurred on the moon. He would have imbibed battery acid before admitting the closest he had ever come to fainting dead away was that very moment. As it was, his knees had almost buckled, but he was able to attribute his weakness to the injuries inflicted upon him by McCann. DeFore answered Kane's question.
Quavell's pregnancy may be endangered.
Stocky and buxom, with deep bronze skin that contrasted starkly with her intricately braided ash-blonde hair, the medic's brown eyes glinted with frustration and anger.
The irregularities in the genetic sequencing of the fetus have grown more pronounced. I don't know whether it's a temporary condition or something that might result in either a birth defect or a miscarriage.
Kane kept his expression composed, even though he felt the anger DeFore directed at him. The medic had never disguised her antipathy toward him, or rather what he represented. In her eyes, as a former magistrate, he was the embodiment of the totalitarianism of the Vills, glorying in his baron-sanctioned powers to dispense justice and death. At one time, she had believed that due to his mag conditioning, he was psychologically conflicted and therefore couldn't be trusted. Although her attitude toward him had softened somewhat over the past few months, the earlier resentment now flashed in her dark eyes. In a way, he didn't blame her, since he had steadfastly refused to cooperate in ascertaining whether he was the father of Quavell's child. During one of the arguments he had with her about his stubbornness, DeFore mentioned that the DNA specimen she had taken from the fetus defied every familiar pattern, even those the computer was programmed to recognize.
Well, what can we do about it?
Us? Nothing.
Lakesh jabbed his finger toward Kane.
But you can do something.
Kane felt a flush of anger and shame warming the back of his neck. His eyebrows curved down to meet the bridge of his nose, and he opened his mouth to voice a profane repetition of the reasons he would not submit to genetic testing. Before he could speak, Quavell silenced him.
You can travel to the moon with me,